Señoras, señores, I'm afraid my Spanish is not good enough, so I will address you in English. I apologize for this, but I have a limited understanding of Spanish. At least I can follow when people talk about me, but I'm not sure I can give a whole talk in Spanish. So first of all, let me thank you all for coming here tonight. Let me thank the Fundación Rafael del Pino for their very kind invitation and for hosting this event tonight. And thank Manuel Muniz for being the person behind it all and who's organized my visit here to Madrid. As you have just heard, I published a new book which came out 2 days ago. And the title is In Defense of Europe, Can the European Project Be Saved? It's been published by Oxford University Press, and I gave the presentation in Oxford on Tuesday, London Wednesday, and I'm here in Madrid on Thursday. So let me say, let's find out. So this is the beginning of the presentation. There are two questions I would like to try to address tonight. One is, what's gone wrong with the European project, and is something that is only limited to the last few years, and this is one of the main arguments I try to put forward. And second, what are the main challenges and choices facing us Europeans today? Before we talk about what's gone wrong, we have to remember that the change in the mood in Europe is dramatic and in a relatively short period of time. Remember that only as late as the early years of the first decade of the new century, up to 2003-04, there was a widespread mood of euphoria in Europe. Europeans were determined, apparently, to change dramatically the economic and political order in Europe through the adoption of a constitution, a common currency, through what is called in English a Big Bang enlargement, extending Pax Europea to former communist countries of Central and Eastern Europe, and also with the belief that in a post-Cold War world, European soft power would become the norm in international behavior. And now this mood of euphoria has been replaced in recent years, and let us be honest about it, by a state of doom and gloom. There is widespread pessimism across Europe, and there is a sense of defeatism. Things are going wrong, and they are beyond increasingly our control. So let me try to explain, in the short time I have available, what I think went wrong. Let me start with the two crises that are known to everybody, namely the Eurozone crisis and the refugee crisis, and then continue. The interesting question as far as the Eurozone crisis is concerned is, how is it that an international financial crisis originating in the United States becomes an existential crisis of the euro and European integration? Because the answer is not obvious, right? And I think the answer has to do with a combination of four factors, at least, namely poor design, bad luck, internal divisions, and wrong policies. Two words for each one of them. First of all, poor design, that I think it should be obvious. We decided back in the early 1990s to have a common currency, but we were not prepared to have either the institutions or the policy instruments or the legitimacy base which are necessary to run a proper, sustainable monetary union. So we thought that we create a European Central Bank, we declare a common currency, and the rest will follow. They don't follow easily. So when the crisis came, we were badly prepared. But then the crisis is really bad luck. Why? Because to have the first test of your young currency coincide with the biggest international financial crisis since 1929 is bad luck, right? And then on top of it, we became very divided. The divisions we've had inside the Eurozone during the crisis are probably the worst divisions that Europe has experienced for decades. And then this was followed by wrong policies. If you want, we could elaborate further in the discussion what I understand by wrong policies. Now remember, what is the result of all this? The result of all this is that Europe, and the Eurozone in particular, has paid a huge price in terms of lost output, lost jobs, increasing debt as a percentage of GDP, growing economic divergence, and political fragmentation. Let me give you two illustrations what I mean by that. For the average Eurozone country in 2015, the per capita income was as high as it was in 2007. So for the average Eurozone country, it's a decade lost. For countries like Spain, not to mention Greece, it's more than a decade lost, right? Because we are still behind what we were in 2007. Now, so one lost decade in economic terms. Now, in some parts of Europe, including notably this country, you have very high unemployment. And usually, if you want to find what youth unemployment is, you multiply unemployment by two. So there are large parts of Europe where youth unemployment is of the order of 30 to 50%, which means that on top of a lost decade, some of our countries are facing the prospect of a lost generation as well. And that's very serious. Now, if you think that international financial crisis is bad luck, then the collapse of a large part of your neighborhood is one piece of bad luck to many. Okay? Because this is precisely what's happened in recent years. Now, remember what is the background. Much of our neighborhood consists of countries that are losers from the process of globalization. Countries with very weak institutions and corrupt political elites. We tried to export our neighborhood policy, which was an attempt to exercise soft power on the cheap, as I put it. This was challenged by two things. One is that Arab Spring turned badly. And then the second thing that happened was that Mr. Putin decided to challenge our attempt to export Pax Europea to our shared neighborhood. The result of the collapse of the neighborhood has been exporting to Europe refugees, immigrants, and also terrorists who join forces with domestically grown ones. Now, the problem of refugees and immigrants is not just a question of 1 million in 2015. It is that given the state of Europe's wide neighborhood, the potential number of refugees and immigrants is very big indeed. And it is a number that I think Europe will not be able to handle politically or socially. Now, the main argument I'm trying to make here is that those crises are big enough, externally generated crises that have shaken the European Union and European institutions and have reduced support for the European project. But this is not enough. If you want to understand the European crisis, you have to go deeper and further back. What are the arguments I would like to put forward? These are the long-term underlying trends. Now, I believe that European institutions suffer from overstretch. And this overstretch is the result of an ever-expanding European project in terms of functions and membership. This is the story of European integration in the last 60 years. The number of functions and membership has multiplied, but at the same time, the center remains weak, and the legitimacy base on which the whole thing rests remains weak as well. So the euro is an extreme example of overstretch. Then that is not enough. The other long-term underlying trend is there is an increasing division between winners and losers. What do I mean by that? I mean that European integration became increasingly part of a globalization process in a neoliberal political context in the last 20 to 30 years. The effect is unequal, not only between countries, but even more so within countries. So European integration became increasingly a divisive issue. It became identified with the process of globalization, and the result has been that the old permissive consensus on which European integration rested has begun to break down. If I were to summarize the history of European integration over the last 60 years, I would summarize it this way, namely, ever bigger, more intrusive, less inclusive in terms of internal divisions, and also in a deteriorating economic environment, which is not our fault. So this is more or less given from outside. Now, is that just a European problem? I submit to you that it isn't. There's a wider problem facing most developed countries today. And I would put it as follows. How do you reconcile global markets with national democracies in conditions of slow growth and widening inequalities within countries? This is almost an impossible combination. So this is a problem that is not affecting only Europe. It is affecting also the United States. Okay? And there is a Harvard economist, Danny Roderick, who wrote a book a few years back called The Globalization Paradox. What is the main argument of Danny Roderick? He says that the world today, especially the developed world, is faced with a trilemma, not dilemma, trilemma. Okay? What is a trilemma? The trilemma consists, as it is a trilemma, of three things: global markets, sovereignty, and democracy. And Roderick argues that in this world we are in today, you can only have a combination of two out of three. You cannot have three at the same time, which means if you want to have global markets, you have to choose between sovereignty and democracy. And if you want to have both sovereignty and democracy, you better forget global markets. Now, there is a European version of the globalization paradox, only much stronger, because Europe has a much higher interdependence between our countries, and also because the expectations of most of our citizens from the political system are higher than they are, for example, in the United States. Europeans expect much more from public power, state power, than Americans do expect from their political system. And the problem in Europe, but this is again a subtle distinction, that's the paradox, that Eurosceptics either fail to understand or pretend that they do not understand. Most of the Eurosceptics in Britain, or Europhobes, confuse the constraints imposed by EU membership with the constraints imposed by being a member of an interdependent world. So they pretend somehow that if they cut themselves off from EU membership, they will have independence. But in order to have independence, they will have to cut themselves off from an interdependent world. And this is something that they usually pretend they do not understand. Now, problem in recent years is that I believe that one of the main roles that Europe could play today is to be our collective answer to managing globalization and representing collectively our interests. But the perception in our electorates, in our citizens, is increasingly that Europe has become part of the problem and not part of the solution. And this is really where I believe is the crux of the political failure in European countries, that Europe has now become increasingly seen as part of the problem and not as part of a desired solution. Europe suffers partly because of the limited ability of European institutions to deliver. It also suffers, of course, because many of our national politicians have the habit of using the EU as a scapegoat. Anything that goes wrong is the fault of Brussels. But there's something else. And this is what I would call, to use the American expression after the Iraq War, collateral damage. Europe suffers because of the problems created by a globalization process. And the people who are unhappy with the process of globalization, the people who see themselves as losers from change, consider Europe as being part of a system they have to fight against. Now, this feeling is obviously much less strong in this country and in the South in general. It's much stronger among the losers in the North and the West. Now, what is the state we are in today in Europe and have been for some years? Europe has not been so weak and divided between and within countries for a very long time. This is a sad statement to make, but I believe it to be true. Number two, support for European integration has declined dramatically across Europe. The lowest figure, according to Eurobarometer, was in 2013, when that was the peak of the Eurozone crisis. It's slightly better now, but not much better. But at the same time, Europeans are afraid of the cost of disintegration. So we are in a very strange situation. The way I would present it is that Europeans very often feel like being in an unhappy marriage in which they are scared of the cost of divorce. So what keeps the marriage together is the fear of the cost of divorce. Now, fear can keep marriages for some time, but it is not the right recipe for success or for happiness. So we are in trouble. And then there is low trust in political elites, which is not only just European integration, and it's not just European. Look at what is happening in the United States. And there's a rise of anti-systemic parties. And there's populism. Now, my very quick statement on populism, and this is perhaps to provoke you a bit, is that, of course, there is that. How do I understand populists? Populists are people who, faced with complex problems, pretend that there are simple solutions, and perhaps anodyne solutions. That's one of my definitions of populism. But instead of simply denouncing populists, we have to understand what are the causes of public discontent. What are the reasons that are giving rise to populist resurgence? Because it doesn't come out of the blue. Why is there a resurgence of populism now and wasn't there 20 years ago or 30 years ago? And therefore, I believe that in our individual countries and at the European level, instead of simply condemning populists, we should try to tackle the causes of public discontent. And there are many, and we could discuss them if you wish later on. Now, the road to Tipperary, what do I mean by that? I think that the state we are in today in Europe is reminiscent of the old joke about the guy who is in the Irish countryside and gets lost and asks a local which is the way to Tipperary. And the local says, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here. So this is how it feels in Europe today. We wouldn't like to start from here, including the Eurozone. But we have no choice. I mean, that's where we have to start from. The question is how to make the best of it. Now, and therefore, the road to Tipperary is going to be difficult. It's going to be a very rough journey. And it is not a good journey for faint-hearted travelers. The question is, under what terms do we want a European project, and for what purpose? And let me submit to you that there are some very difficult decisions and choices that need to be made in the next few years. And there are no simple answers. There are no painless answers. Let me give examples of what I mean by difficult trade-offs. But that's precisely where populists come, and they pretend those trade-offs do not exist. They will give you an answer that makes you happy on all fronts, but of course they cannot deliver. Let me give an example. One example is about sovereignty and effectiveness, which goes further back. You know, some people pretend, I use an expression in the book, but I will not use it perhaps because I don't want to shock you. I'm making a comparison between sovereignty and virginity. Well, I will say it since I have said it. I say that many people, especially Eurosceptics, pretend that that sovereignty is like virginity, which means you either have it or you don't have it, or usually you pretend that you do. Now, in real life and in the real world, sovereignty is not like virginity. Sovereignty is shared. The question is how much share you're prepared to do and what kind of sharing of sovereignty. And that is the real answer. But people talk, let's say, about climate change. Of course, you cannot have an effective policy on climate change on a sovereign basis. But that's obvious. Let me give you an example about taxation. Now, remember that in the European Union, taxation, especially company taxation, is basically, I mean, it's not something that you make great advances because it requires unanimity. And anything that requires unanimity at the European level rarely advances very much. Now, in a world of fast mobility of international capital, taxation of companies, especially of very large multinational companies, has become a very easy exercise. It's what I call in English a cottage industry. And now, in recent years, the European Commission, one of the things that it has been doing and doing effectively, is going after companies like Amazon, like Google, and so on, that have been signing agreements with individual countries that enable them to avoid taxation. Now, if we still believe that our states need money to redistribute, for example, to deal with the problem of inequalities, you must levy taxes somewhere. Now, if company taxation is a race to the bottom, the only way to deal with that is at the European level. Nay, what do I mean by the European level? Have at least a minimum agreement on how do we handle taxation of multinational companies. Because if we don't have an agreement at the European level, we will have a race to the bottom, as we've had in recent years. Let me give you another example, which is more related to economic policy. We have discovered over the years, from evidence all over, that inequalities within our countries have been rising very fast. This is unlike what we've been trying to sell to our populations for 30 years. Now, and then comes the European Commission and other organizations and say that countries need to do structural reform. I'm all in favor of structural reform. But very often what people have in mind with structural reform is further deregulation, and especially further deregulation of labor markets. Now, further deregulation of labor markets in most cases increases inequalities. Okay? Now, is there, and that is a very touchy issue, I know it's a very politically highly controversial issue, is there a trade-off between competitiveness and inequality in our societies? And if there is, what is the answer? And of course, the answer will vary depending on your ideological basis. That, I think, is an even more difficult question for social democrats, which they've been unable to address in recent years. And then I think we also need to think out of the box. There are sacred cows in European integration. One of the sacred cows is free movement of labor. Now, here I may provoke many of you. I think that at some point you may have to consider restrictions that if you go above a certain level of threshold. The British, I think, have a point on that issue. The British are the biggest recipients of intra-EU labor movements. And if the British, and I hope they don't, decide to vote to leave next week, the main reason would be immigration. I think there, the rest of Europe has made a mistake in not making a bigger concession to Mr. Cameron. And if that mistake leads to Brexit, that is going to be a mistake we will deeply regret, assuming, of course, that you agree that Britain, even as an awkward partner, is much better to be part of Europe than outside. I think I'm taking too long, so I'll go faster. Now, let me give you two other examples. Very difficult decisions. The monetary union, I believe, is still dysfunctional. The governance of the euro is neither effective nor legitimate, despite the changes that have taken place in recent years. And if you want me, I can elaborate what I mean by that. I believe, to put it again in slightly provocative terms, the way it was designed, the euro was a big mistake. The way it was designed. Because you can have a common currency, but as long as you are prepared to do the rest. But you cannot have a common currency without institutions and without instruments and without any political base. This has never happened in history. Okay? So the EU, the euro was probably a big mistake the way it was designed, but I believe it would be an even bigger mistake to undo it now. Virtually all economists agree that this is the case. Well, if you agree with that proposition, then how do you handle the wrong policy mix and the huge democratic deficit of the Eurozone? You need major changes, and you will need a treaty revision. Now, when you mention treaty revision in most national capitals, and in Brussels in particular, people have heart attacks because, you know, they have the experience of previous treaty revisions and of referenda, and they don't want to go through it again. So they say there is no appetite for European integration. My answer to that, perhaps a bit populist answer, is my appetite always depends on what is on the menu. Unless I'm starving. And the menu that I've been served in the last few years has made me anorexic in Europe. So there is a serious problem. So the question is not here whether we want more or less Europe, it's what kind of Europe do you offer to people? And I believe that a proper revision that addresses real problems, not just technocratic, that addresses the problem of symmetry of adjustment, that addresses the problem of how do you create growth, how do you deal with non-inclusive societies, may have a different reception from the country. I'm not suggesting that it's going to be easy. I will say in the end what happens if we fail. And of course, there is a problem and a big, difficult, very awkward question is how much room do you have for misfits in the Eurozone? Because the Eurozone is a highly heterogeneous group. Now, foreign and security policy. Everybody says, and I agree, I used to agree, that foreign policy would be the last thing that goes into the melting pot. Yet, remember, there are three things that are happening, or four things that are happening. Number one, the international center of gravity is shifting steadily away from Europe and towards Asia, away from the Atlantic towards Asia. Number two, size matters a great deal in international politics. No European country is big enough to carry much weight at the international level. Many of the Eurosceptics who pretend that Britain will cut itself off from the continent and become glorious once again live in another world. Number three, much of our neighborhood is in a complete mess. It is a wide arc of instability. And number four factor, the US security umbrella, with Europe being the free rider on security provided by the United States, should not be taken for granted for much longer. Now, if those four factors are true, the question is, are Europeans ready to become adults as far as foreign and security policy is concerned? I'm not sure we are, but I think it's a key question. And then if it's going to be cooperation in foreign security policy, I think it's going to be more intergovernmental with big countries leading. Perhaps very briefly on Britain, I am getting increasingly worried. I came back from London yesterday. Everybody's worried, including people in Downing Street. But the things are turning badly. I think at best it's a 50-50 thing, what's going to happen next week. It could be a major disaster. I think the choice for the British really is between a special status, because already they have a special status, but with a seat on the table, and the hypothetical preferred status of a third country to be negotiated sometime in the future. Okay. I'm not sure that reason will prevail next week. And Europe will need more differentiation to accommodate Britain, but not only Britain. But I'm going through this fast, and I'll come to the end. What's my last slide? I think the stakes for Europe are very high indeed. You know, people say all those things that I went through, the choices, the trade-offs, extremely difficult. Europeans are not ready for those things, which is probably true. But let us think of what are the consequences of us not rising to that challenge. I think it is obvious, if we fail, that the prospect is of a weak, declining, and increasingly irrelevant Europe. And it could be even worse. And let me add the last bit. Some people, especially of my age, might say that we are not able to change fast, but in any case, we still have a comfortable standard of living. We can decline in grace. My answer is that neither Mr. Putin nor much of our neighborhood may be willing to allow us to decline in grace. And I would finish there.